Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at prices everyone can afford, which is free, and available whenever they're interested in listening to it. Today, we're doing a show, and surprise, it's not about predictive coding. Yes, there's been a spike in coverage on predictive coding, and I apologize for the biases for the show's creator and producer, but today we're covering a much bigger issue, global e-discovery, and how international e-discovery plays out in the U.S. courts when different e-discovery rules might govern, different privacy laws are involved, and sometimes, as is always the case in litigation, the answer isn't completely clear. Jurisdiction issues with privacy laws that are inconsistent strike right at the heart of discovery and make international litigation a tricky affair. As part of the show, we're profiling a free website offering, an e-discovery passport, which was created by Symantec, to help parties navigate these issues. We don't often profile tools just directly to ESI Bytes, but when they're free, I can't see the harm of doing so and only see the benefit. And I'd also like to add, since we're mentioning a commercial tool in the show, that no one's being paid to do this at ESI Bytes. I'm not paid to do the show. The show's not being sold to anyone. It's free discovery information and training being offered to the field. So it's all about education. So whatever you do with the free information is up to you as consumers. Our guests for the show are a great group. We've got Magistrate Judge James Francis IV, who's been a United States Magistrate Judge in the Southern District of New York since 1985, serving as Chief Magistrate Judge from 1998 to 2000. Judge Francis graduated summa cum laude from Yale College in 1974, where he was a member of Phi Beta Kappa. He received his Juris Doctor degree from Yale School Law School in 1978 and a Master's degree in Public Policy from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University in the same year. Following graduation from law school, Judge Francis clerked for the Honorable Robert L. Carter in the Southern District of New York. He then joined the Civil Appeals and Law Reform Unit of the Legal Aid Society, where he conducted impact litigation in the areas of housing, education, and the rights of disabled persons. He's also an adjunct professor at Fordham University Law School, where he teaches constitutional torts. M. James Daly, my friend Jim, is a co-founder of Daly and Fay LLP, a boutique law firm devoted to helping global clients reduce legal risk, contain costs, and ensure compliance with records management, electronic discovery, and data privacy obligations. Jim is a frequent author and speaker on global records management, e-discovery, and data privacy issues. His service and publications include co-chair of the Sedona Conference Working Group 6 on International Electronic Information Management, Discovery and Disclosure, 2005-2012, senior editor of the Sedona Conference, International Principles on Discovery, Disclosure, and Data Protection from 2012, contributing author of eDiscovery and International M. Rich Strike and Datenschutz, which is a lot of German words in here. I'm German. I shouldn't have butchered that, but I did. And editor-in-chief of the Sedona Conference Framework for Analysis of Cross-Border Discovery Conflicts, a practical guide to navigating the competing currents of international data privacy and e-discovery from 2008, among many others. Phil Favreau, our final guest, is discovery counsel for Symantec Corporation in Mountain View, California. During his 11-year litigation practice, he advised technology companies and other clients regarding complex discovery issues. Phil's expertise has been enhanced by his legal scholarship. His line of research addresses the changes and challenges that electronic data have forcibly introduced into litigation, and in particular, on discovery practice. He's been a member of the California State Bar since 1999, and is also licensed to practice in Utah. He belongs to the ABA and is a member of the ABA Science and Technology Section. He's a member of the Sedona Conference and contributes to Working Groups 1 and 6. Phil previously chaired the Santa Clara County California Bar Association's High Technology Law Section and was a member of its Board of Trustees. Phil, glad to have you and everyone else on the show. And so let's start the show. And first, I'd like to ask each of you how you first got started in e-discovery. And largely, Phil, it's because you haven't been on the show before. I like to ask this question to start off. So why don't we start with Judge Francis, and then Jim, and then Phil.
Sure. I got started as a product of serendipity more than anything else back before the 2006 amendments, when they were first being considered, I think it was in the year 2000, Judge Shindlin was going to one of the first colloquia that the Rules Advisory Committee was setting up with practitioners and judges and so forth out in San Francisco to talk about what the problems were and whether rules were needed at all. And I think she was looking for a traveling companion, so she asked me to go with her, and that was my first exposure. Once exposed and being interested in the intersection between technology and the law, I began to focus on it a little bit, and then I got an early case, Roe against William Morris Agency, that raised issues of cost shifting in e-discovery, and as a judge, once you write one opinion, you become an expert. So when I wrote an opinion in that case, I began to come to conferences and so forth where these issues were discussed, and then it pretty much snowballed. I continued to be interested, and issues found their way to me, and I guess the rest is history.
Okay, great. Jim, how about yourself?
Well, my story with respect to e-discovery is a pretty long one. I actually started programming in college, undergrad, and have always had a passion for technology and law. And so during law school and after law school, I continued to take programming classes, try to apply programming principles to make the practice of law more efficient and productive and less costly and less time-consuming, and did a lot of work with ABA committees in that regard. But continued my education in technology, received my master's degree in information services management in 1995 after 15 years of really trial defense work, trying cases. I was fortunate to get a position which was founding an e-discovery and technology law group for Shirkhardy & Baker, a multinational law firm. And in that context, I had a chance to get in on the ground level in some of the first e-discovery battles in the Castano class action litigation and then state of Minnesota litigation involving the tobacco industry, and then in cases involving, you know, pharmaceutical companies and all manner of other multinationals as time went on. So had the, unique experience in 1996 of negotiating with data protection authorities in Germany and France and Switzerland, trying to get parts of data out of those countries to bring it over to U.S. federal court for various discovery obligations. And at that time, the EU directive was just about a year old. So it was a very interesting time to be involved, and have really enjoyed and benefited from I work with the Sedona Conference, Working Group 6, on international issues over the last number of years. And so really, it's by way of that combination of that passion for law and technology that's brought me to e-discovery.
Okay. And Phil, how about yourself?
Well, I'd agree with Judge Francis for myself as well, that it's been mostly serendipity. Practicing in a business litigation firm out here in Silicon Valley many years ago, was litigating a professional malpractice dispute, and counsel from both sides had adopted a mutually assured destruction idea that neither side would ask for electronic discovery and they would just ask for paper documents. But after about 2 to 3 years of the case winding its way through the discovery process, a large court order came down against my client, and all bets were off, and the e-discovery wars, if you will, began, and found that we had to address e-discovery on the fly and deal with a lot of issues that hadn't been dealt with before in my prior practice. It was a fantastic opportunity to learn the ins and outs of how to address electronic discovery. And then from there, I have ended up dealing with several large cases that have addressed various e-discovery issues at the federal level. And my interest in the field was such that I felt that there needed to be some additional scholarship out there on issues such as the preservation and production of metadata on records management. And I published some articles, I authored some articles that were published by some academic journals in the past few years, and eventually made my way over to Symantec to address these issues at the company as well. But like many, I've gotten into this field because the circumstances called for it, and the old way of doing things, printing out emails, printing out documents off of Word, simply were not going to be acceptable anymore, and we needed to get up to speed on how the real world was handling these issues and how it was going to affect us in litigation.
Okay. Well, let's jump into the topic of international e-discovery. And Judge Francis, why is this such a complicated topic?
Well, I think you can think of it in terms of a couple of different layers. One is the legal layer, and there you could think of it as a conflict of laws issue, since you have different discovery regimens, different regimens with respect to the privacy of data. But it's a conflict of laws problem where, first of all, the court and oftentimes the parties have insufficient information about the law of the foreign jurisdiction. That is, American courts are unfamiliar with the privacy and other laws in the foreign jurisdictions and have to be educated in that regard. But beyond that, there's uncertainty with respect to what choice of law principles you would use to resolve this conflict. You know, in a normal conflict of law situation, you look to the choice of law of the forum, and there are certain relatively straightforward rules for making those choices. Not so in terms of international e-discovery. So you've got both of those legal problems when you confront these issues. And then you have an overlay of what you might call technical or practical problems. For example, identifying exactly where information is stored, what jurisdiction actually possesses or is the repository for information that's being sought. What about data in the cloud? Where is that resident for purposes of the application of privacy laws and the application of e-discovery protocols? So I think you've got both the legal and very serious practical issues that make this complex.
So, Jim, we did an ESI Bytes podcast on this topic back in 2010 called Navigating the Rivers of International E-Discovery or something like that. So bring us up to date on this topic, on what has happened of note in this field. Is it still a river or is it an ocean now? I mean, where are we on it?
Well, Carl, I think it's still a river, but it's kind of like the muddy Missouri. It's not real clear yet with a lot of obstacles in our way. And certainly, I think it's one that still has quite a few rapids in terms of hazards as well. So the most we can say is that, like navigating any difficult waterway, one has to understand the risks and be able to do creative and innovative things to try to mitigate those risks. With respect to the international cross-border discovery context, really, that means looking at initiatives such as those by the Sedona Conference through its international principles that was released December of last year, following up on the international framework document that came out in 2008. Those documents that are available free of charge at www.thesedonaconference.org provide practitioners, courts, and clients alike, I think, with a user-friendly guide, framework, and set of principles and guidelines for how to deal with some of these risk issues. And some of the things that are recommended, of course, include use of discovery, protective orders in discovery in the U.S. to help kind of extend that bubble of protection for certain personal data that's transferred from, say, for instance, Europe or outside the U.S. to the U.S., doing things such as requiring safe harbor certification or encouraging that so that there's the same commitment to handling of sensitive data abroad and in the United States, looking at ways to add additional data security to that data to make sure that there aren't any unexpected and unwarranted breaches of that information while it's in the U.S. for legal or regulatory purposes. And then, of course, a major development that has kind of come on the heels of those initiatives is the European Union regulation that was passed by the European Commission on January 25th of this year. I had the pleasure of being over in Brussels and involved in some of the consultations with the European Commission and Working Party on that new regulation and the impact of that new regulation. And, I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit here in the broadcast, but just a couple highlights are that if this new regulation is passed as expected by the European Parliament, that's been a two-year process, it will require, for instance, data protection officers in any company that does business in Europe with over 250 employees globally, it will provide for a penalty of up to 2% of gross annual income for violations of the EU regulation. It will provide one-stop shopping for EU data protection and privacy as it relates to cross-border discovery, rather than have to deal with 27 different member states and their own flavors of the data protection and privacy laws. And it will implement a concept called privacy by design, which will require companies doing business outside the U.S. and Europe and many other countries to bake in privacy protections with respect to all their systems that deal with personal information. And that obviously has a big impact on the bottom line as well. So it's a real interesting time in terms of international cross-border discovery and international data protection and privacy in general.
Interesting. So, Philip, I read your blog post in eDiscovery 2.0, and you made some interesting observations about the difference between U.S. litigation with somewhat well-defined rules on what we can ask for in eDiscovery versus some very unclear standards in other countries. Would you care to comment on some of the differences?
Sure, Carl. The U.S. notion of discovery is really unknown in a lot of the world. For example, in continental Europe, the concept of American discovery is simply non-existent. The obligation to disclose documents is limited in most of continental Europe to simply turning over that which supports a party's claims and no more. Discovery devices such as categorical docket requests, interrogatories, and requests for admissions are simply unavailable. This is different, of course, in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, parties are obligated to disclose information that's adverse to their claims, and I'm speaking specifically about England and Wales. However, again, the concept of categorical docket requests and interrogatories and requests for admission simply are not available for the most part. And parties do not have what they consider to be in the U.S., which is a no-holds-barred version of discovery. And so those are some high-level distinctions. There are several others between the U.S. and various other countries throughout the world. But that's one that really comes to mind as separating our litigation traditions and those, for example, in Europe.
So, Judge Francis, being in the Southern District of New York, you obviously see more than your fair share of internationally flavored litigation. And do you get the sense that there's forum shopping in this field, just like we learned about in civil procedure, except instead of state court versus federal versus which jurisdiction, you now are dealing with different countries? And as a follow-up, that's got to be an awfully complicated thing to deal with, right?
Well, I certainly have no doubt that there's forum shopping. What I can't really tell, and perhaps the practitioners on the panel will be in a better position to comment on this, is whether the extent to which that's driven by e-discovery issues. My sense is that it's more likely that the perceived empathy of a particular court on substantive issues is going to drive the forum shopping more than the availability of certain discovery protocols. In response to the second half of the question there about how do we deal with these, I think courts are beginning to get a little bit of a handle on the problems that are created and are developing some strategies. I guess as a formal matter, courts recognize the need to respect foreign sovereignty and issues of comity, just as the courts do in terms of determining when to use the Hague Convention as opposed to domestic discovery tools. And in that respect, the courts are guided by the Aerospatiale case from the Supreme Court and the factors that it identifies. That's sort of the formal analysis. Outside of that, I think courts are beginning to adopt strategies for dealing with these issues, and they're practical strategies. One is to avoid or narrow the dispute by focusing on discovery that's necessary to the litigation, as opposed to the American view that anything that is that touches on relevance is discoverable. When it comes to cross-border issues, I think courts are at least encouraging the litigants to focus on what is really critical, and that's probably a good discipline to have in any event. The other thing they're doing is that they're staging discovery. They're encouraging the parties to take the domestic discovery first, and then and only then, to the extent that there's information important to the case that's unavailable in this country, do we worry about that which is only available abroad. Only if there's unique information do we get involved in the weeds with respect to these problems.
Yeah, so it's sort of like text messaging, where people don't oftentimes look for text messaging. It's there. It's complicated. Foreign data might fall in that same bucket. So, interesting.
Yeah, Pearl? And if I might add one thing to what Judge Francis said on the relevant versus critical, is that if a request goes abroad to, say, the United Kingdom, for example, pursuant to the Hague Convention, and it asks for information that's relevant, chances are that a UK court might construe that as being quite broad according to their discovery traditions. And Judge Francis' emphasis on seeking which is critical, that which is critical, is important, because that may be narrow enough that the court in the UK that actually reviews the international discovery request perhaps grants it in part, such that the litigant can get some of the information looking for. But a broad-based request looking for relevant information, chances are that it's going to be thrown out by the English judge.
Yeah, I think to put it in practical terms, when you're dealing with cross-border issues, you want to avoid the any and all documents language that you see in every document request in this country.
I would agree with Judge Francis's analysis. Really, it's the five-part restatement test that is articulated in the Aerospatiale case, and which has been followed with just some minor modifications in cases citing Aerospatiale, really looks to a number of factors, including how important is the interest of the foreign entity. And I think those of us that are practitioners really can do a service to administration of justice and help Judge Francis and his colleagues in their duties if we can provide that information to them. That is to say, if your client strongly believes that they are between a rock and a hard place and their choice is the Hobson's one of violating the federal U.S. discovery obligations on the one hand, or violating non-U.S. data protection privacy regulations or blocking statutes on the other with the attendant criminal and civil sanctions, then you ought to be trying to get the foreign state that's involved to provide an affidavit or declaration or some kind of testimony or indication to Judge Francis, to the court or a regulator, that indeed they take their privacy interest in blocking statutes very seriously, and they really want everything reasonable to be done in terms of minimizing the data processing and transfer necessary to satisfy U.S. court regulations, and to provide and for the court to provide some kind of acknowledgement and protection against the onward unauthorized transfer of that information beyond the confines of the case or controversy. And of course, those are all interesting and delicate issues. But I think in one respect, practitioners probably have not been aware of that need to provide U.S. courts with indeed some objective evidence of the interest of the foreign entity in this issue.
I would second that. I think that there are a couple of cases from across the river here in the Eastern District of New York where courts have rejected the responding party's objections to discovery abroad because those parties didn't provide the kinds of detailed affidavits describing how that foreign country really does want to enforce its privacy and blocking statutes. And in the absence of that kind of affidavit, the responding parties had to turn over the information or risk sanctions.
Interesting.
And I think it's helpful for counsel to know about recent developments, such as the new proposed EU regulation, to know about the In re Christopher X case, in which there actually was a publicized enforcement of the French blocking statute, and to be able to articulate those data points to the court in the U.S. So that we can get beyond just the kind of erroneous spatial assumption that foreign entities are not going to enforce their blocking statutes or data privacy regulations, and they're just using them as bargaining chips. Having said that, I think the only way forward is to try to, again, through Sedona Conference, through DRI, through the American Bar Association, through the International Bar Association, through OECD or APEC, to really try to find some common ground and to, really compromise with respect to those things that we can to respect and recognize each other's interests.
So, Philip, Semantic released some free web-based summaries to help in this area. Would you care to provide an overview of what an e-discovery passport does and how you hope it should help?
Sure. So, and to give context on this, let me refer back to the plug that Jim had put in for the Sedona Conference and some of the materials from Working Group 6. And for example, there was a set of international data privacy and discovery provisions that Working Group 6 released about 3 years ago. It's a fairly deep dive on a number of discovery issues affecting practitioners in probably about 9 to 10 countries or so. And we felt that was an excellent resource, but we wanted to provide something for organizations, for laypersons, and for lawyers that would be a little bit more straightforward and provide some basic overview of these discovery and data privacy provisions that I was referring to earlier. And that's what the passports are intended to do. We've got 9 passports that are up on the website right now that predominantly cover, again, key disclosure and data privacy provisions, international data requests, and the like. And we'll be adding several others from other regions in the coming months. But our expectation, and this would answer the second part of your question, is that this will be a resource that will help lawyers and laymen alike get up to speed on some of the issues and bridge the knowledge gap that exists as to global legal processes. And that is, there's a large knowledge gap in this country as to what is going on in other countries in terms of their legal processes, discovery, data privacy, and the like. And when we wander into those countries having no idea how to proceed is when we get into trouble as lawyers. I think Judge Francis mentioned that there's an emphasis of trying to structure discovery, domestic versus foreign, trying to take care of the critical domestic discovery in, say, a particular case, and then going to the foreign discovery. However, I would add that if a litigant knows that there are critical issues that need to be addressed with foreign discovery, that leaving it to the last minute may not be the best course of action because, and this is something that, the passports also touch on tangentially, they aren't typically adhered to international discovery requests with the alacrity that's expected under Rule 34, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. There could be delays of several weeks or months or even years, depending on the country it served and the information requested. And this information that we're putting out is trying to generate greater awareness of these processes and also trying to get lawyers thinking ahead and organizations thinking ahead about the type of evidence they need and when they need to get it. So that would be my analysis of the issues.
Yeah, and I'd like to add, when we decided to do the show, I went on the site and you know, I clicked on the passport link, and I saw a little box that I had to fill up some information. I thought, who's going to call me? Well, this is a show, so I'm gonna do this. And I hit send, and 5 seconds later, I received a white paper on Germany in like four pages. It was literally 5 seconds later, you know, of some general themes. So I was impressed, and no one has called me yet. So. You know, anyway, Jim, as an attorney who counsels clients in this area, how can you be comfortable to be on top of what is a global issue? I mean, there are standards across countries. Are they similar enough to be bucketed in the general themes, or is this just pretty complicated?
Well, you know, there are some general themes that, that can be found looking at the various countries around the world that have these data privacy and protection regulations or secrecy statutes or blocking statutes. And really the best way to compare and contrast those are by looking at resources such as the one that Philip mentioned, by looking at the various websites, for instance, the EU Commission website or the websites for the OECD, so www.oecd.org or www.apec.org. If you look at those websites as well as the Sedona Conference materials and the resource that we're talking about that Semantic has sponsored, you'll have a pretty good ability to compare and contrast the various different types of approaches around the world. I will say that the EU directive that's been in effect since 1995 has been kind of the template for most of the common law and civil countries around the world. There really are, fundamental principles such as access to your own personal data, the ability to withdraw consent even after consent has been given to the processing and the transfer of that personal data, the theme of not authorizing transfer of personal data from your country to another country that doesn't have adequate privacy protections. The theme of having to have some kind of a treaty or cooperative arrangement, such as the U.S.-EU Safe Harbor Agreement, to support cross-border transfers even in a business context. The requirement to have some kind of data security to stop the flood of breaches of personal data that we've seen so much of in the news in the last several years. So there are those common themes. You know, one that is a little bit different that's worth noting is Brazil, Argentina, and Mexico have a unique tradition of what they call habeas data, which really provides some even more robust substantive protections to individuals with respect to their personal data. You know, they have the right to, in essence, obtain that data from whatever source it's located. So that presents some challenges in terms of technology, social networking technologies, as well as cloud computing going forward.
Okay, and the keeping the update is an important question. Is Symantec going to work hard to try to keep that e-discovery site updated? Because I can tell you from running ESI Bytes, it freaks me out that I got shows now that are 3 years old up there, and there's no way for me to possibly keep an old show updated. So buyer beware, it's free.
Well, we don't want to be promulgating misinformation or stale information. You know, a good example would be the EU data protection rules that were recently promulgated by the European Commission. Now, those rules aren't yet, they haven't been enacted, if you will. They still have to go through the EU member states and the EU Parliament. But if and when they are approved, then you will see most likely that the passports will be updated to reflect those data privacy provisions in particular. And in, I would say briefly updated, we don't want to do those provisions are 119 pages of content, so it's quite substantial. But we would try to synopsize that information concisely and do so when they became effective so that we had some timely information up there that would be current for our readers.
So, Judge Francis, what are the biggest mistakes you encounter as a judge in this area that are hard to fix? I know we pointed out one of not bringing an affidavit in of the foreign jurisdiction's interest, but are there other mistakes that you see?
Yeah, I'm not sure all of them are impossible to fix. It sort of runs the gamut, but let me outline a couple of them. One particularly knotty problem involves the interplay between the EU privacy requirements with respect to destroying private information and obligations that parties and counsel may have in American litigation with respect to preservation of exactly the same data. So you've got foreign obligations to destroy it, American obligations to preserve it, there has to be a recognition early of that problem and bring it to the court. On one hand, you don't want the party to be destroying it willy-nilly in order to comply with the privacy laws and thereby violate the preservation obligations. On the other hand, you don't want them violating the privacy law. So they need the court's attention early on something like that. Another area is the issue of selective disclosure. Parties have to be very careful because sometimes they will rely on information for purposes of their affirmative claims or defenses, and lo and behold, similar information that would be helpful to their adversaries, they withhold on the ground that it is beyond their ability to disclose because of privacy laws or blocking statutes. So that doesn't set them in a good light to the court when they're utilizing the privacy laws as both a sword and a shield. In more practical terms, I think sometimes there's a failure to acknowledge custody and control when information is in fact within the control of the responding party, but may be subject to some of these privacy laws. That is, the parties have to be candid with the court about the difference between their actual control of the information and their ability to disclose it legally under the foreign jurisdiction's laws. And finally, another practical issue is just whether parties are aware of the location and accessibility of the data that they have. You know, we run into so many instances where parties can't tell you in what jurisdiction their information is located, and it requires a certain amount of digging even to find out that basic information. So there are some of the things I find problematic.
Jim, that's a good lead into my next question about compliance advice in this complicated field, because you know you've got your weeds and you've got your strategic level, and is your advice don't do anything with international information without researching first? But you know, mistakes are often made in the field, not by chief legal officers. So it seems like a complicated balance to get compliance done the right way.
Well, it is a complicated balance, and you're right. Sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing in terms of, negotiating or choreographing, I guess is a better word, choreographing the need for consent to processing and transfer personal data in Europe, for instance, that needs to come to the U.S. So here's what we generally recommend with our clients and work with several of them to accomplish, and that is to develop some very robust protocols that can then be validated to the extent possible with local data protection authorities in those countries where you're operating and implementing them. And those protocols deal with things such as obtaining written consent from data subjects or employees at the same time that they are put under legal hold, because legal hold itself is an example of a type of processing of data outside the ordinary course, which is prohibited unless there's a legitimate basis for doing so. So providing that clear and conspicuous consent at or about or before the time that legal hold is issued to individual employees. The second thing is developing some protocols around collection and segregation of truly personal sensitive data from other data. See, the definition of personal data outside the U.S. is so broad that it includes emails that name an individual and the to from our CC field. So obviously that's very, 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 very restrictive, and allowing the employees some means to segregate out their, you know, personal financial information, pictures and such, takes on a whole another layer of importance outside the U.S. So providing some mechanisms there, providing some kind of in-country culling so that there can be some reduction of the amount of data to only that which is truly relevant before it needs to be further processed or transferred outside the originating country. And lastly, looking at ways to try to review that information and further, you know, cull it down, reduce the funnel at the top to that which is necessary to be transferred by doing in-region review, or considering some kind of review mechanism that again will help reduce that amount. Some of those third-party indexing and search and retrieval products that are out there these days can really help in traversing that line and balancing that U.S. interest in discovery and non-U.S. interest in privacy. So those are some of the things that can help with compliance. I think having a company data protection officer, having some kind of way to validate your protocols with your local data protection authorities, having at least some in-country outside counsel available when necessary to test the waters or to put the finger on the pulse of cultural and legal variances or differences between countries is an important strategy as well.
Let me ask you a question about that, Jim. That raises an interesting point at the risk of raising predictive coding in this context.
Yeah, I was about to do it. I was trying not to. But thanks, Judge.
Do you think that the authorities in the EU, for example, would be receptive to using technology to do this kind of culling, or would they react adversely if there's the inadvertent disclosure of private information when one of those tools is used?
And I'll add to that, you know, it could be done randomly with just a, you know, a few thousand documents. You don't know what you're going to uncover, but the whole goal is to eliminate the junk that, you know, there's a cost-benefit analysis here on privacy. And so anyway, Jim, go ahead.
Well, all roads obviously do lead to predictive coding, as we know. I think generally European data protection authorities and data protection authorities around the world would welcome the use of technology. And I would say, I would use the term predictive classification and categorization rather than predictive coding, because in this instance, you're using it fundamentally to help on the front end, to help reduce the amount of information that's even dealt with on the front end rather than on the back end. So, for instance, in terms of the desire, most countries outside the U.S. to really restrict what is being retained, even retained that might be potentially relevant for litigation, use of predictive classification, categorization, types of technologies are ones with great promise. You know, if you think about, for instance, if you think about all the work that's been done on data loss prevention technologies and antivirus protection technologies, and then using those in a creative way, turning them toward helping with that reduction of data that's being retained to begin with. It's only going to be helpful for businesses and in the legal context to achieve savings to the bottom line, or achieve the just, speedy, and inexpensive resolution of disputes on the other.
Right.
And Carl, to Jim's point, and also to what Judge Francis was saying, if you think about Rule 1, compare it to what's going on in the United Kingdom. Their equivalent, they have an equivalent provision called the overriding objective, which basically says you've got to do the exact same thing. Again, so there are differences between these systems, but there are great similarities. And in our country, we're trying to get litigants to adopt principles of proportionality. Those principles have been in place since 1983, since the federal rules were amended in 1983 and re-amended in 2000. But proportionality is the lodestar or the touchstone of all litigation in the United Kingdom as well in continental Europe. And technology is one of the keys to being able to make sure that discovery is proportional and that we can fulfill Rule 1's objective that it be done efficiently and cost-effectively and in a defensible manner.
Yeah, and that's why Chris Dale is so busy over there talking about using these types of tools. So, really interesting line of thought there. Well, going back to the e-passport, Phil, what's the connection of Symantec to this issue? I mean, free is something I understand at ESI Bytes. Isn't it unusual for a large company to join the open source movement? Glad to have you in the space, but there has to be some type of a connection.
Well, Symantec's a global company, and Symantec has products and services that address information retention, data security, and e-discovery across the globe. And the passports are just another form of service or product that are meant to bolster and strengthen the information security and the processes that companies are trying to implement. And whether it's Symantec customers or other organizations, again, this idea that there's a substantial knowledge gap on what's going on in the world with respect to legal processes is something Symantec wants to help bridge. They're trying to be a source of information, a source of help to companies. And given that there is this gap, the passports, like the Sedona Conference materials and the other materials that Jim had mentioned should help in that regard.
So, Judge Francis, do you see these issues continuing to grow over time? I mean, Symantec's going to be offering, I saw on the website, next information on Asia. And, you know, Jim was talking about some of the issues that occur in South America. You know, it just seems like this is going to get more and more complicated.
Well, it's going to get more complicated on a number of different levels. First of all, you have the obvious increasing globalization of commerce generally. So there are lots more issues that are cross-border. You have the increasing globalization of individual companies. An individual company is no longer going to be based exclusively in one country or another. And you have emerging markets. So you're not only getting EU privacy laws, you know, you're getting Burkina Faso privacy laws or blocking statutes and so forth, and that makes it all the more complex. I think the other way to look at it, though, is that with the kinds of initiatives that Sedona has and with the EU's standardization of some of its privacy laws, you may get more cooperation and more of what I think was referred to earlier as one-stop shopping. That is, you're not going to have quite the same crazy quilt of regulation that you once did. And because the issues are becoming recognized, you're going to have more understanding cooperation between countries and across the borders in terms of how to deal with these issues, whether it be by a convention or by treaty or simply utilizing some of the tools that we've talked about for reducing the friction between two different regimens.
So, Jim, obviously mistakes are made in this area all the time. What can you do when a mistake is made to fix or minimize the problem? I mean, let's say you have a problem in France. Are you facing the guillotine? Will your headless body serve to advise future companies to heed the privacy laws, or are there ways to solve problems?
I think the best way to resolve problems is in advance. And sometimes you don't have the luxury of being proactive, and you have to deal with a reactive situation. And there it's a more delicate balancing of transparency versus potential liability and consequences. But if you find that a problem exists, the best practice is to try to remediate that problem as soon as possible. And if there is still time to do so, involve the data protection authority in that dialogue and truly try to find a cooperative way forward. And if it's in Germany, deal with the Works Council in advance. If it's in France, deal with the CNIL, their data protection authority. And every country is going to have somebody that generally can be contacted to engage in that dialogue. I think most countries do prefer that. There are some exceptions where, and it's no secret that in Spain and Italy, those data protection authorities are looking for opportunities to fine you because that's how they get their revenue. That's how they fund their operations. So you know, it is a jurisdiction by jurisdiction kind of a risk calculation, but certainly if you see an issue where you have a practice or procedure that may not be up to snuff, you know, the best time to fix it was maybe last year. The next best time to fix it is today.
Well, we're near the end of the show here, so I'd like to just ask the last general question. You were here in April of 2012. What do you see as the biggest issue in e-discovery right now? It can be involved in this show or this topic or any topic. I'll start with you, Judge Francis, and Jim, and Phil. This helps me come up with new shows, so I don't mind asking this question.
Well, I think a lot of these issues sort of overlap, but I guess if I could identify a single issue that's I think of overriding importance, it's proportionality. And obviously cost and proportionality, how we can deal with issues in litigation in a way that the e-discovery costs don't outstrip the value of the litigation.
Okay. And Jim?
I think in my practice, the most important issue right now from a kind of a risk perspective and a cost perspective is the remote review. You know, is it legitimate to, for instance, use technology to help allow your attorneys who might be based outside of Europe to review information that is located on databases or on servers within Europe? Again, for the purpose of reducing that funnel at the top, the purpose of reducing that amount of data that might ever need to be transferred to as small amount as possible. Now, technically, there are issues in terms of remote review, both from a processing and from a transfer perspective under the current EU data protection regulation or data protection regulation, and under the proposed amendment to that once passed by the European Parliament and Council of Europe. But I think that is an issue that goes directly to the bottom line and directly deals with the nub between competing notions of privacy and competing notions of discovery. And with review being, you know, 75% or more of the cost of e-discovery, that's a big nut.
Interesting. Okay. And Philip, yourself?
I'm right on board with Judge Francis. Proportionality, to me, is front and center the big issue that needs to be addressed. I even published a blog post this week on that very subject and how some of the more recent cases that have come out in the past couple of months in particular, but over this past year and a half, are really pointing to how organizations and their counsel need to address proportionality and need to do so if we're going to be able to control the runaway train that is delays and excessive cost of litigation. And there are a few district courts that really get proportionality. You see that from the local rules. You see that from the cases. But my sense is that the country as a whole, every single district court is not getting this issue still. And if we are to be able to address these issues, lawyers need to be able to understand the proportionality regime that's in the federal rules, and courts need to be able to implement that regime such that costs and delays can be reduced. But it really requires work by us as lawyers to ensure that we don't have unnecessary discovery, that we encourage reasonable discovery efforts, that we get away from some of our dilatory discovery tactics. And as Jim alluded to with some of the processes and technology he mentioned, that we have for our clients better information governance practices. If we can see those four principles implemented, and I write about those in a post I posted this week, I think we would see a reduction in costs and a shortening of the time frame that we see discovery addressed in American litigation.
I would just add to that that if you haven't seen it yet already, I would suggest people look up the RAND Institute study that just came out this week on the cost of collection processing and review and e-discovery. It's a real interesting 150-some-odd page read, but it's based on data, and you know it's the type of thing we need to be studying to really get win the battle on proportionality, is to understand the cost side too. So. Well, I'm promoting all sorts of organizations on the show. So thank you, Judge Francis, Jim, and Philip for joining us here at ESI Bites. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out as Easy Bites of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of Review Less, wishing you a nice day.